One of the top stories in the UK right now is the tragic disappearance and likely murder of a 33-year-old woman called Sarah Everard. Everard went missing last week after she left her friend's house in Clapham, London, after 9 p.m. on her way home to Brixton. Now, it goes without saying that this is a terrible occurrence and the person responsible should be brought to justice and locked up forever. But the response to this on social media once again highlights the complete disconnect between how people perceive the world to be and how it really is. The dominant narrative being pushed by the loudest voices is that the burden of blame for Everard's disappearance lies not necessarily just with the perpetrator, but with all men in general. A Green Party politician even got up in front of the House of Lords and claimed that all men should be put under a 6 p.m. curfew.
I would argue that at the next opportunity for any bill that's appropriate, I might actually put in an amendment to create a curfew for men on the streets after 6 p.m, which I feel would make women a lot safer, and discrimination of all kinds would be lessened.
The hashtag Not All Men also began trending before it was soon dominated by Me Too advocates and male feminists, many of whom have hijacked the tragedy to create yet more division between the sexes. If your response to the Sarah Everard case is to say not all men, then you're part of the problem. Do we really have to raise our daughters to be careful to walk home at night because they might get murdered? This is a man problem. We need to own it, challenge it, and change it. No, it's not a man problem. It's a murderer problem. It's a violent crime problem, it's a policing problem, and it's a self-defense problem. Do you really think would-be murderers are going to be prevented from murdering if you just tell them not to murder? Murder is wrong, don't do it. Oh, okay then. Should we tell our daughters not to walk alone late at night through dangerous areas of London where sexual assaults, acid attacks, stabbings and murders are becoming commonplace? Yes! That's not victim blaming, that's not misogyny, that's pure common sense. There are no safe spaces in the real world. The real world is a dangerous place. We have an entire generation of people who have been re-educated to think that the biggest threat they'll face in life is mean words on the internet. That's why they're so shocked when reality jolts them with a sobering reminder of the actual threats. And thanks to the lockdown policies that many of these people overwhelmingly support, while people are being stabbed to death in Croydon, while women are being abducted off the streets in Clapham, where are the police? Breaking up house parties, handing out fines to people for sitting on benches. Meanwhile, while knife crime surges to all-time highs, women aren't even legally allowed in the UK to carry pepper spray. The blue check marks will grandstand until they're blue in the face about how much concern they have for defenceless women. But when you suggest allowing women to be armed to fend off dangerous attackers, oh no, we can't have that. A woman in the UK caught carrying pepper spray will face the same legal penalty as carrying a gun. That's utter nonsense. If you really want to protect women, stop criminalising self-defence. This will reduce the risk of attacks from day one to an infinitely greater degree than moral panics, vigils, or hashtags that blame an entire gender, but they're never gonna do it. It's a fact that women in the UK are stalked, harassed, followed home, and in the worst cases, abducted and killed. But it's also a fact that the law offers them no sufficient legal means of protecting themselves. So the law needs to change. Violent criminals aren't going to be deterred by social media outrage. Many of them will be deterred by a blast of caustic chemicals to the face. The horrific irony here is that many of these people whose knee-jerk reaction to these kind of tragedies is to blame toxic masculinity will vote for the same parties who enact the same policies that put women at greater risk. After over 1,000 women were molested and raped in Cologne on New Year's Eve 2015, almost entirely by North African migrants, how did feminists react? Did they go nuclear on social media? Did they demand curfews? Did they demand border controls, better integration? No. They went to the local migrant centre and handed out flowers. 1,400 young girls in Rotherham alone were kidnapped and abused by sex traffickers over a period of 16 years. Where were the vigils? Where were the campaigns? Where was the outrage? In comparison, it was virtually non-existent. Acid attacks, honour killings, forced prostitution, human trafficking, rape gangs. suddenly there's outrage. London itself has become significantly more violent because of the open border policies that have worsened gang violence and emboldened violent criminals. I've made numerous videos about countless cases of young women who travel alone to dangerous areas of the world. And because they've been indoctrinated by society and the media to believe in cultural relativism, they think it's no different visiting tourist hotspots in Venice to visiting mountainous regions of Morocco. It's very different, and the risks are far greater, because all cultures are not equal, and all cultures don't have the same view towards women. Which is why there have been innumerable high-profile cases of women who make those dangerous trips alone and never come home. You're not gonna stop murderers by getting hashtags trending, holding vigils, or telling murderers not to murder. That utopia you created in your head doesn't exist in the real world. You can't stop evil with retweets. You can reduce the risk with better use of police resources and decriminalizing self-defense. Women should be able to visit any area of the world without being stalked, harassed, or abducted. It's not their fault that they can't do that. But still, we have to be realistic. We don't live in that utopia. It never existed, and it never will. And no amount of hand-wringing over misogyny or contrived moral panics over toxic masculinity is ever gonna change that. It's absolutely crucial for you to help me fight the war on free speech by supporting me via Subscribestar, link in description, and also signing up for my free newsletter at summit.news/newsletter. Another tragedy, another sickening rush to exploit it to push more racism and division. A gunman in Atlanta, Georgia killed 8 people in an attack on 3 local massage parlors. The media and the left immediately pounced to amplify the narrative that white supremacy is responsible for a massive increase in violent hate crimes against Asian people. The Daily Show's Trevor Noah. The Atlanta shooter blamed a specific race of people for his problems and then murdered them because of it. No, he fucking didn't. That never happened. The shooter explicitly told cops he targeted the massage parlor employees because he blamed them for his sex addiction. The FBI director Christopher Wray said, quote, "It does not appear that the motive was racially motivated. It had nothing whatsoever to do with race." Noah spends 5 minutes exploiting the tragedy to push a narrative about racism and white supremacy, when the attack had nothing to do with racism or white supremacy. He completely omits and ignores the fact that the gunman killed 2 white women during the attack. Do they not count, Trevor? Do their lives not matter? This tweet and this video is literally fake news. The very definition of it. Over 1 million views. No Twitter warning label, no clarification, nothing. What does it say about news broadcasts and comedy shows, which at this point have basically merged into the same thing, are so thirsty to demonize white people that they have to brazenly lie about mass shootings? Don't we have enough polarization and division in society already without you having to invent more? We're told COVID hate crimes against Asian Americans are on the rise because a year ago, Donald Trump said that COVID came from China. But it did come from China. It didn't come from the fucking moon, did it? But let's take it at face value that hate crimes against Asians are on the rise because of COVID. That's wrong. That's terrible. Why? Because it's unfair and discriminatory to blame an entire race of people for the actions of one government. You don't stigmatize and demonize an entire race because of the actions of a group of individuals. Unless they're white, of course, then apparently that's not only permissible, it's institutionalized and encouraged. CNN, white supremacy and hate are haunting Asian Americans. The Root, whiteness is a pandemic, only way to stop it is to isolate it and kill it. Imagine if I responded to yet another weekend of bloodshed in Chicago by calling for blackness to be eliminated. I'd be called a racist. Because that would be racist. Because it's racist to stigmatize and demonize an entire race because of the actions of a group of individuals. Yet with absolutely no proof whatsoever, the narrative continues to be amplified. Violent hate crimes against Asians are on the rise, and it's all white people's fault. Really? One of the first instances of violent hate crimes targeting Asian people in America after the emergence of COVID was perpetrated by a black man who punched an Asian woman in New York because she was wearing a face mask. It received barely any media attention at the time, and there was no attendant moral panic about the rise of hate crimes against Asians. According to Russell Jung, professor of Asian American Studies at San Francisco State University, quote, "We're really careful to note that this violence against Asian Americans in high crime neighborhoods has always been high." High crime neighborhoods. Gee, I wonder what that could be a euphemism for. If the left wants to get into a debate about violent crime and per capita demographics, they're probably gonna lose that debate. White masculinity fetishizes and dehumanizes Asian women, and it's intrinsically tied to racism. It's crucial that we don't erase the way that misogyny and racism operate together to justify killing Asian women, tweeted feminist Liz Plank. That's odd, because Liz was noticeably silent when Kamare Lewis and his friend raped and beat 36-year-old E. Lee to death in a park in Milwaukee, Wisconsin last September. A tragedy that wasn't followed by waves of mainstream media hand-wringing over white supremacy and hate crimes targeting Asians. Wonder why? The media would have you believe that this wave of violent hate crimes targeting Asian people is wholly the responsibility of white people, when it clearly isn't. And it isn't the responsibility of black people either. Because again, it's racist to stigmatize and demonize an entire race of people based on the actions of a group of individuals. So why, when it comes to white people, has the media made an industry out of it? Because there's a lot of money, attention, and political power in fanning the flames of racial division. The grift is real. Take Trevor Noah's fake news video. His solution at the end of the clip is to donate money to anti-extremism groups. The same groups whose entire funding and existence relies on generating constant hysteria about extremism. If there wasn't enough extremism to justify the millions they receive from governments, foundations, and giant corporations, they'd need to invent it. And they do. They don't want racism to subside. They don't want us all to live in harmony, because they'd all go bankrupt. Their entire raison d'etre is totally dependent on whipping up racial tension, which is why they do it at every available opportunity. Same goes for the media. Amidst an environment of news outlets going bust, contriving moral panic surrounding race is guaranteed clickbait. That's why they bend over backwards to platform professional race grifters on the left. You know, the kind of people who say, it's not enough just to be racist, you have to be anti-racist. Quite ironic that, generally speaking, all those people turn out to be massive fucking racists. The media is institutionally racist against white people. More specifically, white working class people and white conservatives. That's why they'll literally invent fake news to stigmatize and demonize an entire race of people for the actions of evil individuals. There's also the tremendous guilt that white bi-coastal elites feel over being wealthy and privileged, which is why they continually dump their projected insecurity on white working class people. While I refuse to be the dumping ground for the likes of Trevor Noah, Stephen Colbert, and John Oliver. I refuse to be demonized because of the color of my skin, an immutable characteristic I don't even control, by an establishment that is itself institutionally racist. By an establishment that profits from stoking division, societal turmoil, and racism as an integral part of its business model. It's absolutely crucial for you to help me fight the war on free speech by supporting me via Subscribestar, link in description, and also signing up for my free newsletter at summit.news/newsletter.
This podcast is a production of the Salem Podcast Network. For more podcasts like this from courageous voices of conservative reason, visit salempodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Dennis Prager Show on this last day of March. And I'm going to go straight to my guest, Sarah Carter. She is an investigative journalist. She's traveled with migrants for the last month. She's fluent in Spanish. Her excellent website is sarahcarter.com. Sarah, welcome to the Dennis Prager Show.
Oh, it's so great to be with you, Dennis. Thank you so much for having me on your show. And by the way, my daughter, who's at University of Wyoming, is a huge fan of yours, and so is my son. So I just wanted to throw that out there, a nice shout-out from them.
I'm very touched, actually. Thank you for that. I spoke at the University of Wyoming a couple of years ago. Just for the record, you will get a kick out of this. So needless to say, I was attacked in advance for the usual bigotry and phobias. And along the list in either the Laramie paper or the University of Wyoming paper, the writer wrote, "And he's an anti-Semite." Yeah.
Oh,
so it proves there is a list of terms, and they're just used. There's no basis. There's no backup. There's no proof. Nothing. It's just.
Actually, I laugh, but it is really quite shocking and really quite sad that at a university that they would use that term, correlate that term to you. It shows that they haven't even done their research.
Right.
They know nothing about you.
That's
that
right.
They're just willing to believe whatever lies are being spewed out there, disinformation campaigns out on the internet. So it really is, even though I laughed a little, it is quite frightening, Dennis. I mean, it's hard to believe that in this day and age when we're supposed to have so much technology that gives us so much access to information, that there's so many people out there with such little information and factual information.
That's right. Well, it's the use of epithets to dismiss, never to debate. Anyway, it was just a memory. I had a great time there. The speech is actually on the internet, and how socialism makes you selfish, which is probably
right.
More necessary than ever. Okay, so I'm curious about you. Where did you learn your Spanish?
From my mother, from when I was very, very, from the moment I was born, probably, I was hearing Spanish. My mother is from Cuba. She's an immigrant. She came in the 1960s on the Johnson Freedom Flight with her sisters and her mother, my grandmother, who I love dearly, and who passed away at the age of 102, believe it or not. So I learned from them. I mean, that was the root of my... not only my knowledge of Spanish, but also my background and the reason why I'm so passionate about immigrants and about people that are fleeing to find a better life. Now, my mother came in, you know, during a time when Cuba was tumultuous. Fidel Castro had taken power. Obviously, our family were not supporters of Fidel Castro. They left on the Peter Pan and Johnson Freedom Flight to find a better life in America. And my mother always used to say that the moment she landed, well, they landed first in Florida, but they were sponsored by a family actually in California. One of the churches, a doctor actually in California, sponsored my family. And my mom said from the minute she landed in California, met the family, you know, whenever anybody would ask her, and she worked so hard, she got her, you know, of course, her citizenship and everything, they would say, "Oh, you're Cuban." And she'd say, "No, I'm American. No, I'm American. I left Cuba. I'm an American." And she believed so much in this country. And my father was not Cuban. He was American. He was actually born in Alabama and was a World War II veteran. And a much older father. And he used to, I mean, just amazing how much he loved and the passion he had for our country and, you know, the stories I would hear from my father. But I think what really rooted me in the way that I am was both of them, but I grew up in an immigrant neighborhood. I know what it's like after my father passed away. You know, I traveled all over the world when my father was alive. I spent a lot of time in different countries. I really have a grasp for that. I have a real passion for people. And I think that's what has driven me to cover stories along the U.S.-Mexican border and in Guatemala and in Honduras. I mean, I've spent a lot of time in different parts of the world in my career.
What has... In your view, what has changed at the border from when Donald Trump was president?
Oh, it's so far worse. So far worse. I always tell everyone, I've been covering the border since the Bush administration. There was only one president, and I remember the border even before the Bush administration, believe it or not, but there was only one president that actually meant what he said and did what he said, and that was actually President Trump. You know, and I don't know how people took it. I mean, it's a very difficult subject, right? The issue of immigration, the issue of people fleeing their country or young people, undocumented. I mean, it's a we look at the humanitarian issue when it comes to that. But I want people to understand that are listening to this right now. And I'm saying this just because this is what I have experienced and what my knowledge is from all the years I've covered the border. The crisis, the humanitarian crisis, is perpetuated by the fact that we don't have established rule of law that we follow through with. That was going into not only from the Bush administration, but going into the Obama administration. We saw those changes in the Trump administration just in the 4 years that he was like, nope, these are the rules. We will not allow you to come in until you are processed. Now, you got to stay over there. We're going to process you through. We're going to find a better way to do this. But we can't just allow and perpetuate this type of behavior where drug cartels, human traffickers, and corrupt politicians and others are basically using human beings in a political game. You know, they're pawns in some kind of political game. And you see the results of that. You see children dying on the road. You see rape and predators targeting innocent migrants who were used in this political game. Not only just, I'm not just blaming the United States here. There are also pawns in political games in Central America and South America, all over the world. And they get mixed messages. And when I'm down there talking to them and I say to them, you know, especially on this trip, let's talk about this last month. I don't put words in their mouth. I say, what made you come here? Well, President Biden. Because that's what we're hearing everywhere, that we have 100 days to get into the country. President Biden isn't turning anyone back. My family came in last week. They called me. They said they're getting processed. You know, they hear it from word of mouth. They hear it on the internet. They hear it from corrupt politicians or people who maybe want to target the United States. You know, and they'll use Biden's own words. They'll use Vice President Kamala Harris's own words to lure people here. But you got to see the consequences of this. And the consequences of this are lives lost, young children, young girls. Imagine being 7 years old on a journey from Honduras, going through three nations, being brought in by people that are not your guardians or your parents. What do you think happens to a young child like that, or a young teenage girl, or a young boy for that matter? These children are targeted. They are destroyed, I think, spiritually inside. You know, some of them, I've had young girls where, you know, where they've let me know, and I don't want to, you know, talk too much about this, where I've had to go to the Border Patrol and say, could you please get her to a doctor? She has more than likely been raped, and she needs to be checked. You know, she's only 13 years old. So, you know, when people say that, you know, laws, you know, are stopping, you know, all these wonderful people from coming into the country, realize that some of these wonderful people are being trafficked by the most horrific people on the planet. And that's the horror of it, Dennis. And I think that's what, you know, breaks my heart. It's the reason why I keep going back to the border. It's the reason why I've traveled to Guatemala 3 or 4 times. It's the reason why I'm going back. It's the reason why I'm, you know, I'm so focused on, you know, our nation's laws and
so
how
tell
that
me
our national
what is the average individual from Honduras or Guatemala, let's say, what would they answer to you? Gee, I didn't know this happens. It's worth the risk. It's extremely rare. They don't want this to happen to their children. So what would they respond?
Well, it's based on who you're talking to. They don't ever really say it's worth the risk. Like, if their child has been harmed, I think, and they're a decent human being, they would say that they can't believe that this actually happened, that they actually thought that they would make it in safely. But I got to tell you right now, Dennis.
All right, wait, tell me right. Don't forget what you want to tell me right now, Dennis. That's... Because I'm very interested in hearing the response to that. Sarah Carter is at sarahcarter.com, and she is sort of embedded with people coming in the southern border. I'm Dennis Prager. Hi, Dennis Prager here again with a message for anyone struggling with pain. Of course, I want you to know about Relief Factor, the 100% drug-free supplement that tens of thousands are now taking every day. I take it every day. I like being out of pain. But I know you may be skeptical. I certainly was. Then I kept hearing about all the people, including my wife, who were no longer in pain. So I decided to give it a try. In fact, listen to Janice's story.
I was skeptical at first, but because of the pain that I was having when I would substitute teach and have to climb stairs, so I have lower back, hip, and even knee pain. And after about 3 weeks, I found that I could climb stairs pain-free. But it wasn't only pain-free. I could do it step over step without holding on the railing. I'm really happy. It makes me feel like I'm young again.
That's relieffactor.com or call 800-500-8384. 800-500-8384. And it's the last day of fundraising. It's the 31st of March. Sarah Carter is my guest. She is with Fox News and her own magnificent website, sarahcarter.com, and spends a lot of time at the southern border. So I asked you, given the terrible things that can happen to especially a child, what is the attitude of a person in Honduras or Guatemala? I'll take my risk. I don't even know there's a risk. What is their view?
Look, I think they realize there's a risk. There's a reason why we see, and you know, I'm going to be frank here, Plan B, different types of birth control on the trips. I talk to people here. I'm here meeting, like in Virginia, immigrants who have come in, illegal immigrants who have come in, and legal immigrants who have friends in their neighborhood who have traveled in from Honduras and other parts of the world, and they're just willing to take those risks. Sometimes life is just really tough, even in those countries. I don't take that away. You know, but then I talk to people here and they say, well, you know, MS-13 moved into my neighborhood. I talk to people who are legal immigrants in some of these underprivileged neighborhoods, and they'll just be like, I remember under the Trump administration, one person in particular who I know very well, said, oh, we're just so grateful because no MS-13, no new MS-13 gang members have arrived in our community in a while, and we want it to stay that way. Like, they were terrified, because what will happen, too, is there's good and there's bad, Dennis. I mean, you just can't say put everybody, oh, everybody's an innocent victim. No, not everybody is an innocent victim. There are a lot of innocent victims and innocent people who are thinking that maybe they can do this, they can find a better life, but there are also a lot of bad people. And there's also a lot of people who have abandoned their children. Their children are raised on the streets in Honduras by gang members. Or maybe their children lost. Maybe their parents passed away. Maybe these children grew up alone. Or maybe they grow up with guardians that aren't very good. And they become a part of a gang on the street. And now they're coming to the United States. There's a lot of layers to this story that are not being told. And so some people, yes, some people believe that, well, maybe we can do it. Maybe we can take this risk. Maybe we can make it safely across the border. There's our family units. There's a lot of people that travel with their children. There's also people that travel with children that are not their children. And they pretend that those children are their children. In fact, in one instance, several weeks ago, while we were walking with a group, one of the kids, I was with a private landowner, he also speaks Spanish, and he asked this little boy, he said, wait, hold on, because the little boy was going up ahead, your father's behind you. You know, and I wait for your father, and he said, that's not my father. And the man said, no, I'm your father, remember, I'm your father. It's like, they think they're going to have a better chance of staying if they tag on to one of the children, say they're their child, they won't get returned back home. And that seems to be the process right now again. This happened under the Obama administration. We saw this in 2013 to 2014. There were about 67,000. I also covered the stories then, 67,000 undocumented children. But remember, there's a lot of what they call family units, and that's taking up the bulk of it. And for a lot of people, they think like, oh, if we come in with a child, then we're home free.
And they're right, I assume.
They are right. They are right.
Is there a difference between the way we see pictures of largely children detained now and under the Trump administration when they were supposedly held in cages?
Well, I think there's a huge difference. We didn't, first of all, it wasn't as many as we're seeing right now. Look, last month we had over 100,000 people come in illegally across the U.S. southern border. We have the area, the facility where I was at, I was reporting on, I had a whistleblower at the Donna facility, which was fascinating to me that I couldn't even believe it when I got down there to see it, these long football field-like white tents with no windows. You know, air conditioning, yes, but absolutely no windows. I couldn't see in. It looked like a prison. The fencing around the Donna facility was double-layered. It was very difficult to see inside. You couldn't even see the people that were being brought in and being dropped off. And this is where the majority of children were being held at this Donna facility. The complaints that it was over 800% capacity. In one particular tent area, there should have only been 80 children. There were over 700 children.
How would this have been reported if this had happened exactly like this, but President Trump were president?
They would have destroyed him. The media would have destroyed him. AOC would have been down there crying. She would have had Rashida Tlaib with her and the whole gang and Ilhan Omar. They would have had, this would have been it. They would have had another impeachment. They would have called him a racist. They would have said every word that could come to their mouth would have described President Donald Trump. They would have torn him apart. And the tragedy here is that there is a real crisis at the border, a very vivid, real crisis. We can see it happening. I'm reporting on it every single night that I'm down there. And other reporters are going down there now, too, and reporting. And the Biden administration refuses to call it a crisis, refuses to call a spade a spade. They put Vice President Kamala Harris in charge of, you know, the immigration policy issues. She won't even go down there. In fact, she laughed. She had a weird, nervous laugh, a cackle of sorts, when she was asked if she was going to go down to the border. And she should be nervous. But she should have said, no, we're going down there and we're going to see what's happening and we're going to find a resolution to this crisis. Because it's not just about the people and the children. Children are always number one, right? They're innocent victims. Most of them, especially if you're talking about very young children. These are the innocent victims of our just messed up world, right? But what about our law enforcement officials? What about our, you know, DPS, Texas Department of Public Safety? What about Arizona law enforcement and federal officials that are on the front lines every day? What about the people that are coming in with COVID?
Yep. Well, you can learn more watching her on Fox News or at sarahcarter.com. You're doing very important work, Sarah. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dennis. Thank you for having me on your show. I appreciate it.
All right, everybody, I want you to know sarahcarter.com is Sarah A. Carter. There's two A's. sarahacarter.com. I think that's obviously very important that you know that. Wow. I'm Dennis Prager.